tonight. We're going to do this final panel, and we have until approximately 12 o'clock, I've been told. So, and we're going to try to do that diligently and very rigidly, because we do have to have the large body logistically get back into the buses and go to the next stage with all of our luggage and the rest of it. Now, you all feel like talking this morning?
Yeah.
Oh, you do? There's no one so exhausted from yesterday that I'm prepared to say, okay, I've had enough, and we'll go on home. No? Oh, I see. Well, that's wonderful. All right, then let's do it. And what we want to do is not to have speeches from the panelists at all, from those of us at the table, but we want to have a chance to see if we can get the issues and or the questions that are most on your minds, and maybe, therefore, perhaps, you can be symbolic and representative of the whole group. What are the things left unsaid? Of course, you know, volumes. But what are the things that you would like to see, what are the things you'd like to hear about that would sort of fill out the picture that you're forming in your own mind at this place in your lives? So that's what we're going to try to do. I'm not having an initial comment other than that to try to see if we can make that happen. Let me suggest now that since it is that kind of a platform, you take about 60 seconds, 2 minutes at the most, to frame your question, to frame your comment, to frame your critique, yes, even that, or hard question. And I have learned a long time ago, I can't put a limit on those of us up here. But I am going to suggest that we freely move back and forth as we feel like it, and respond to whatever question we want to respond to. Unless the question or the comment or the critique is aimed at a certain one of us. All right. Does that seem doable this morning? Okay. Then, how do we get these? We have a mic. Huh? Okay, you have a request. Okay, there's a microphone over here. Is there any other mic?
If someone would like to do a really good deed, and it would be to bring us some water.
Oh, thank you.
I have orange juice.
Thank you.
Okay, all right. All right. How do we want to do this? This is a large room. Only a single mic. If you want to stand where you are, and speak up boldly. Oh, Mark, are we recording this? Oh, we are recording it? All right. Then you have to use the mic. Let me suggest that you keep two or three people at the mic at the same time so that we can move smoothly from one issue to the next. All right. So let's do it. Yes.
I'd like to get us started. A lot has been said about the impact that nonviolence has had with the movement. Not much has been said about the militant groups that were also very active. Do you think they may have served as a catalyst? Do you think they may have served to lead the movement in another direction that may have thwarted your efforts? Or just what do you see the role of the militant groups?
Don't hesitate.
First thing you got to deal with is the word militant.
Get the mic.
Yeah, that's right. And stand up, huh?
Yeah.
No. Is that what you also said?
Boldly.
Yeah, speak boldly and loudly. But the thing is, first you got to deal with the word militant. Okay. All right.
Yeah, so
all right.
People can see.
In that case, I wouldn't have. I wouldn't have spoken up at all if I'd known I had to stand up.
That's not an action, Howard.
But first thing you have to deal with is the word militant, right? Who is militant? Is, in fact, imitating the old, is that militant? Is it even radical enough to be thought of as militant? And always in the mind of those in power, anybody who disagrees with them is militant, right? And when you talk about overturning them, oh, you're really militant. But that's their excuse to kill you. You get my point? So if you're that stupid, you know, we've got to watch it, right? But let's look at the is that there were two movements going on, right? There was the old ideas going on, and there was the Kingian ideas going on. And that's what has to be seen, is that King was talking about a whole new world, a whole new way of approaching problems. And the greatest gift he gave us was to solve social problems without violence, all right? And prove that so that we never have to do that again if we will listen, right? Is that, and it was very clear that the so-called militant groups didn't solve anything, right? And what we have to deal with is that we're dealing in a society, a world, where you have to solve things, huh? Not just, you know, walk around with bluster and noise and the old stuff. It does not fit, right? It will not. See, the thing we have to see is that we're living in a post-King world, right? We're living in a post-King world. The old stuff does not fit. Nobody's going to put up with it anymore. Because, number one, they know it doesn't work. Number two, it doesn't solve anything. And number three, it does not fit the need for solution, right? So that when you really deal with it, they were secondary. Another reason is because, all that praise for some of the guys coming out of various cities who didn't even change their city, much less the nation. Much less systemic problems, all right? Okay, so who needed? Yeah, CCP. Okay.
All right.
That's right. Yeah. Because,
yes, my observation is that many times those groups provided drama and entertainment, you know, with the militant talk. Three or four years after the sit-ins and freedom rides, I decided that I was not nonviolent. I was indeed going to pursue the way that many of the so-called militant groups went. And about a year passed, and I realized that I had not learned to make a bomb, let alone blown anything up. I hadn't been to the rifle range and certainly hadn't shot anybody. That for me, I was more powerful using nonviolence, and I think that's true of many people. During that year, I read a lot of dramatic poetry and had a lot of fun conversations about violence, but had not really changed anything. And I also observed some other groups, the Weathermen and some of those groups, and many of my objectives were similar to theirs, which boiled down to achieving a better world. But when you think about it, it would be impossible for them to attract mass membership, because you would be really stupid to plan and execute murder or bombings with people you didn't know. You'd get arrested promptly. So it was clear to me that they could not attract a mass movement the way we were always able to recruit more and more and more people.
I think my position is pretty clear in terms of where I stand in terms of my philosophy. But to give the benefit of the doubt, I think it's important for us to objectively take a look at what was happening. One thing we don't want to do is do a broad brush and say militants, because there were different factions, different groups, and people who shared different aspects of the philosophy. So it's like nonviolence. We know a lot of people who say they're nonviolent, but they're not talking about the same thing we're talking about. Okay? So that's why CT in the beginning talked about militants. We considered CT a militant. John Lewis especially, nonviolent militant. And there was, of course, no question about Diane. Yeah. And it's the way you describe it. Okay? It's like the word terrorist. Yeah, so we put a label on them, and then that makes it okay. Right. All right?
Insurgents.
Sure. And it's a way of separating people out for a particular reason. Now, I was very close to people who call themselves militants. And it's okay to talk about it. Stokely and I stayed up all night in jail down in Mississippi on the Freedom Ride arguing about violence and nonviolence. I didn't sleep. Okay? And we didn't agree on everything, but we agreed on some things. He was a philosophy major at Howard University, and I was a seminary student, but our education was pretty much superior, wasn't it? We had CT as my homiletics teacher, you know what I mean? And John Lewis and I, Kelly Miller Smith, and we had Jim Lawson. I mean, these were our faculty. You know what I'm saying? You understand what I'm saying? Yeah, that's what we had, a faculty. So we were much further ahead in terms of our approach. Now, here's what happened. The demands and the shouts of black separatism, for example, which people associated with militants. That was one group of militants. There was another group of militants was integrated, black and white folks, but they were against the system. And they used the same method, okay? But they had different goals. So the whole business of the militants, now here are the plus. Number one, it was showed people that they should be active and not be passive. They should stand up and speak up boldly and loudly. That's good, because one of the problems we were having was folks were too silent, like right now. Yeah, we're dealing with, situation with the war, and folks are too silent. That's right. But the militants made up a lot of noise, like Diane said, created a lot of drama. And all that woke folk up. Consciousness raising. Feeling proud to be black. Okay? And the... yeah, the butt part of it. So even with that was no solution to the problem. Just simply raising the issue and getting people stirred up. Now, there are tactics and methods, of course, we don't accept those, because like I told some of the militant friends of mine that they were impotent, because our civil rights leaders were getting shot and killed, and the staunch segregation leaders were safe. I haven't seen any record where they assassinated any of those. They wear bullets around their necks for jewelry, and that wasn't very productive if you're talking about, changing the system. So the point is, it was not practical, number one, in my view. All right? It was cute, loud, but not practical. And besides, it was immoral. And you know what nonviolence says? Nonviolence says that we don't want to be like them. So what you're doing when you respond the way they respond is you're causing them to have power over you to control your response. So we felt empowered, so therefore we couldn't buy into that thing. But they did serve a purpose, black consciousness, identify with Africa, and put on some dashikis and stuff. I got plenty of them. I wear them too. That's okay. You should identify with your heritage. All folks should actually be wearing dashikis since we are all from Africa. That was a Vanderbilt anthropologist who told us that that was the origin of civilization. The Middle East? The Middle East of what?
We're in trouble.
Africa. Yeah. Okay. All right. Jesus? Palestinian Jew. That's what Jesus was. Those believe in Jesus. Yeah. Supporting his people. Yeah. Don't I talk too long, sorry.
It wasn't. Yeah, okay, good. There are a number of books that have been published in the last 2, 3, 4, 5 years indicating that the self-defense posture that we had in Nashville and in Greenville and Birmingham and Montgomery, elsewhere, made a serious contribution to the struggle. I question that. I think that is not cannot be verified. As these persons have said, our concern is that we have serious problems. We want to solve them. And to solve them requires taking pragmatic, communal action that will move us from where we are, even if there's only a half step, toward a little bit of justice, a little more freedom, a little more equality. Incremental steps. Then someone said it's immoral. Yes, the Jewish prophet from the first century said that you do not have the right to retaliate in kind. Do not violently resist the evildoer, is the way he used it. You have no right to self-defense in kind. If it's evil against you, then you've got to find a better way than to repeat the evil to the person who's threatening you. If you follow the way of the evildoer, then what you have done is to multiply the evil and not stop the next attack against yourself or your family. And then the final thing I would say is that there's nothing more militant than what we did. in a hostile climate, in a hostile world, to with our bodies walk and sit down. Yeah, or ride into. Some of you said yesterday that we, when we thought about going to Mississippi in 61, we knew we were going into hell. What's more militant than that? And to do it not with an invading army of hate and violence, but to do it simply with our bodies, our spirit, our love, our willingness to insist that justice for one is justice for all, that liberty for one is liberty for all. What's any more militant than that? I don't know of anything more militant than that. All right, no one's at the mic? Oh, yes. All right, go ahead.
I'd like to just add one thing, and that is, do not believe Jim Lawson. Do not believe Diane Nash. Do not believe any of the people up here.
That's right.
Use your own brain. Listen to what you hear. Weigh it and see what you think. If the Creator had not expected you to follow your own path and your own brain, use your own judgment, the Creator wouldn't have given you your own brain. And I think that's one of the most important things you can always remember. Trust yourself. You got to love yourself as well and respect yourself and respect your own judgment and your own ability. So in terms of what you do, you're always the final judge, or should be.
That's awesome.
Now, believe that. That's hard. This is just sort of to follow up on the previous question. I want to ask all of you more specifically, many of you have gone on to continue your work in institutions, government and academia and various churches. So I want to ask you, how do you, how do you continue your work within larger institutions, acknowledging that there are other people, you know, to move forward, you have to work with other people, but you don't want to, I don't know if you understand what I'm trying to say, maybe I'll let you off.
Let me try to respond. In my own case, I see my involvement in American politics as an extension of my involvement in the civil rights movement. I do not, and I cannot, and I will not separate the two. Sometime, if you watch C-SPAN, you may see me standing on the House floor talking about the beloved community, the creation of an interracial democracy, laying down the tools and instrument of war and violence. And in the next few days, you may hear me saying more of that, that we have to stop the madness and lead. And I said from time to time, and it's not new for me, that leaders must lead. If you believe in something, you go for it. So I have not separated myself from the struggle. And we reach out and try to be a bridges between Democrats and Republicans, between progressives and the very conservative element in the Congress. And that's what we must continue to do.
You want to follow up?
Yeah.
No,
that was helpful. Anyone else who has
a question? Yeah. Okay. Is that the point is one of the real problems, each one of us speak personally as to what we did, not what would have been nice, right? What did we do? Is that one of the central problems I had is how do I stay in the movement when the movement is no longer moving, all right? Is that, what do you do so that you're continuing the work that you know is essential to your life and to the life of the nation? Or to the life of your people, right? Or to the life of the oppressed. Use any one of those words you want, right? But it must be one of those words. Is it, add your own word, but because you got a brain. But the point is, so what I did was to start a company that was an anti-racist company, right? Is that, kept it going for 20-some years, and now my son's doing it. You understand my mind? Now, there's another kind of thing you can do. You don't have to be separated. When Katrina came, I went down and started what turned out to be a national organization, churches supporting churches. No one was even talking about the churches, yet I know that religion, but particularly the work of churches is necessary to a community. I don't care which faith you're using, right? They're necessary to community. Yet there was no talk on the TV, week after week we watched, about what happened to the churches. They were totally destroyed in that African-American community. Total, right? So how do you get the churches back when you're not going to get federal money for it, right? And even when they said they were going to give some, it never happened. Right? Hasn't happened yet, right? So it came to me that Paul had the same problem. How do you start the new church? Is that he collected money from everywhere and took it to various places, right? Is that churches can support churches. Now, I happen to have a couple of flyers here. but the point being is, there's always something you can do. Go where the action is, right? And the other thing that's part of that is that you have two vocations, right? One is the one that's going to make you a living, quote unquote. The other one is the one that's going to make you a life, right? But when you choose your action, choose it in relationship to King's agenda. How does it affect the end of war? and violence, how does it affect the end of poverty? How does it affect the end of racism? Does it in fact deal realistically with creating the beloved community, right? And every one of us can do that, right? Is that that's what changes things. Until these ideas are part of the nervous system of the nation, we have not won. Simply passing a law does not create where we have to go as a moral and spiritual movement or toward really the solving of the basic problem, right? But when we do, then we will have the beloved community. When we do, then we can prove that we're nearing not only the beloved community, but the final thing is the house upon which we all have to live together, right? In the world. Our goals are not simply about black people and white people, right? Our goals are simply about changing the very nature and transforming the world in which we live. It's transformation, not social change, we're seeking.
Okay. That's I want to simply say as strongly as I can, this is now 2007, and so it's not 1961, and that all of us here, I think, would agree that there is an issue of convergence. We cannot eradicate racism without eradicating sexism. We cannot eradicate sexism without eradicating violence. And we cannot eradicate violence without eradicating greed and economic exploitation. It may need to be up in the front, because in all of these things in the United States, sexism, racism, violence, economic exploitation is the obvious common factor. The task is, and perhaps the beginning point of that task, however, is who you are and how you define yourself, whether or not you define yourself as a child of the universe, as belonging to life, your life is a gift, whether or not you sense that that life means you have purpose and being that no one can redefine for you but yourself, and whether or not you see that in that gift there is connectedness to all other life and to especially human life. So it seems to me you take that with you into other institutions. You take that in from 61 to 62 into 2007. All right. Next.
One more comment on that one.
Okay. Diane, you always have the last word.
Takes me a while to put my thoughts together. I sensed in your question some anxiety about being separated from people. You said something about you've got to work with people, and that's true. But there is one of the things that was very important to my life that I learned in your workshops, Jim, was the importance of truth and love as fundamental principles with which to lead your life. I remember when the war started, Bush said something like, you're either with us or against us. And that's not true. I said, not me. That's the wrong question. You're either with truth and love and justice, or you're not. And the people I'm with were lined up with truth and love and justice rather than lining up behind people. Now, that will sometimes separate you from people. And in fact, I have become separated from some people that I love very deeply, some of my family members. Based on that, some people, even those you care about and would love to work with and be with, will not line up behind truth and love and justice. And I'm really careful who I spend my time with, because that profoundly influences my life and my thinking and what I think about and what I do. So sometimes being separated from people is positive. Sometimes you need to make room in your life after you're separated from people who have been there as you grow, because you will then attract positive people close to you to replace them. So, yes, you do need to work with people. But the other side is that sometimes separation is the best thing for you.
Okay, everybody?
Yeah, just a brief addendum. Thinking back over the many interviews that I did for my book, I spent more than a year really trying to do an appendix, trying to figure out what on earth happened to the Freedom Riders in 1961, and recovered stories about more than 300 of them. And what struck me about the results of that search was that when they started seeking the beloved community in 1961, it was a lifetime commitment for them. And even though they were dispersed and were involved in all kinds of institutions, and I'm sure had to make certain compromises, I got the sense that their experiences as Freedom Riders marked them for life, gave them a kind of insight which allowed them to affect every institution that they touched. I think you probably have seen that this weekend, and that they became involved in all manner of causes, the convergence that Reverend Lawson just referred to. And I was struck just briefly, there were three of the former Freedom Riders that I tracked down in Vancouver, British Columbia. And they had helped organize a group called the Raging Grannies Anti-War Movement. And that's just one example. And they dedicated their lives, present lives, to fighting this war. Or another figure, Ed Blankenheim, who appears on the cover of my book. And Ed was a white Freedom Rider from Arizona, kind of a crusty character in his later years. He'd had a stroke and amazing man who died last year. But he was in a wheelchair the last 10 years of his life. And he was arrested in his late 60s for trying to extend the rights for disabled people on the buses of in San Francisco. And it just seemed to me quite amazing. Here was a man who had a stroke who probably could have spent the rest of his life in his room, and here he is getting arrested at the age of 69 for the same causes that he'd fought for when he was in his early 20s. And that's representative, I think, of the whole group. And so even though obviously they made certain compromises to survive, I think that fighting spirit has remained with virtually all of them. They've been freedom fighters for life.
Good morning. When I heard Bernard Lafayette talking about going to other countries and training about nonviolence, the first thought I had was a population that really needs to hear about nonviolence is the fundamentalist Islamic groups. And so if you were to meet with Sunni and Shia leaders and were to start that conversation about moving towards nonviolence, how would you approach that and how would that go?
Well, thank you for that question. It's not an iffy situation, because I will be doing that next month. I'll be going to Israel, and I will be the guest of the State Department, the one that we fund with my tax money.
Which State Department?
The United States Department, the United States and Israel. I'll be their guest, okay? And I will be in Palestine. A year ago, this past Christmas, I was at a conference in Bethlehem. And one of the groups learned that I was there and went and rounded up a lot of the grassroots folk and asked if I'd do a workshop. I did one for 2 hours. My wife was with me, Kate Lafayette, right there, okay? And we had folk who were grassroots, had to be, you had to have a translator. So I had my own translator who translated for me what the translator was saying. Mm-hmm. So we make sure that we got, you know, information over. We cannot separate ourselves from people. I don't agree with that. I agree with that when people are difficult, that is a challenge. And that's when we got to bring forth our very best. Now, what I do agree with Diane said, is you got to decide how much time you're going to spend with them. Because otherwise, you won't have time to do other things. But you have to maybe schedule it, but don't let them off the hook. Don't let them get away from you. Because it might be that very moment that they, okay, might see the light, or maybe you might discover something you haven't discovered. And I can tell you story after story in my family and among my friends, some of my best friends, okay? But you never give up. You don't let them change you. Now, religion is something that man made. Spirituality is another thing that all people have. You can choose your religion, but spirituality is something that's a part of you, whether you ignore it or not. What will we say? Well, one thing I've found that's been very effective is that you simply tell them about your experience. So it's storytelling. That's what it is. And when you tell stories about what your experiences were like, people can relate to those and associate with them. Okay? And the experiences that you've had also connects with their experience. Then you're in a position to establish some kind of rapport. People don't talk to each other very long unless they can see a connection and they feel that you, now you want to see somebody's eyes light up, you turn around and say, well, I'm from Tampa, Florida. You from Tampa, Florida? That's where I'm from. And then, you know, it's a connection. All right? You never met that person before. You don't know what they like. But hey, you found some connection and you start there. So the whole idea is to begin with basic human experiences. Like Diane said, you don't go lecture them and tell them what they ought to think and what they ought to do and they ought to be nonviolent. I don't tell anybody they should be nonviolent. Somebody been telling me that, you know, when I was out there with the gangs. You know what I'm saying? I ain't listen to that stuff. No. But it's where you start. So the starting point is very important. In the first place, you start with gathering information. Don't assume that you know everything. As we used to say in our neighborhood, with the big head. All right? Don't assume you know everything. Go with an open mind to learn and try to understand where that person is coming from and their experiences. So what you're doing is you're looking out of your window instead of trying to get people to look into your window. Okay? So what I would do in my workshops when I'm there talking to these people is trying to understand why they feel the way they do, what they're trying to accomplish, and share with them what my experiences were and what we were able to accomplish. I can't do the workshop now, but because Jim, you didn't see it, but he pulled my pants leg.
before. As soon as you're able to arrange it, Bernard, speaking of people who are badly in need of workshops in nonviolence, I would love to see you arrange a workshop with Condoleezza and with her boss. Since she's the head of the State Department, I think that would be great.
I'm going to add another thought to this, and that is that in my judgment, the nation that needs nonviolence the most is the United States. And the second point I would make about this is that the group, religious group that needs nonviolence the most, that is love, truth, beauty, wonder, is Christian fundamentalism and Christianity as a whole. Because we have probably in the last 500 years supported more disdain of human beings around the world than any other single religion. And it's easy for us to put it off on the Shiites. The third thing I would say is the United States, the 20th century was the century of the United States. And the 21st century may very well be the century of the United States, at least in the sense that now our plantation capitalism wants to dominate the economy of the whole world. And it wants USA military to be available wherever they can be in the world to make that possible and to fight wars where necessary. That, it seems to me, is a pattern out of the 21st century. So I maintain that in whether we like it or not, we are a superpower, but we must become a superpower for exploiting the things that make for truth and peace and justice and community. And that the best lesson we could give to the Shiites and the Sunnis would be for us to become a nonviolent nation and a nonviolent policy.
I love the way you clapped on that. I love the way you stood. You know why? Because that says, let's leave here to do it. But let's leave here to do it in an organized manner. All right? Is it, in fact, your university is one of the major universities of the entire South. There's only about five others maybe, that have as much influence in university life as you do. Right? Is that... Can you, in fact, well, we won't have to argue that point, add five, right? And of course, your personal one will be one of them. But my point is that you have influence in university life. Can you take this to other universities other than your own, right? Can this same thing happen in other places? Can it be extended beyond these tables and this and these grounds, the university itself, right? Because if you can do that, you're on your way to making certain it happens. We win the mass is that you're going to be at this for 40 or 50 years, right? Because you've got that much time left. And if you think about it seriously, this is not for just university life, this is for your life, all right? Is that, now let's take that for instance, is that we're gonna be at the triple evils that Martin talked about, the end of racism and the end of poverty and the end of war. We're gonna be at that to get the beloved community for this whole century, right? So that means we're going to be committed to it for that long. The people that are going to be most for leadership are those that are going to be at the dominant universities of this nation. Can you get them now? Right? Can you influence them now? Can you make certain that this kind of thing happens on their campuses, that they begin to make these decisions? Can they hear about the fact of the power of nonviolence? Can you organize on those campuses to make it happen? To the extent you can, we're looking at least a half of this century that we're going to need, because we're going to need it all to solve the triple evils, right? So that you are part of the true new world that must come about, because we're in the fullness of time for it to happen. The great thing that's happening during your lifetime is the fact that we're going from one mode of dealing with the social problems of the world to another. To the extent you see that, and to the extent you operate within it, does your life have full purpose in terms of creating something beyond what we have? That's the kind of vision that will satisfy the soul. That's again, I'm using soul in a very real way, like you were dealing with spirituality, right? Is that, can you do that? To the extent you can do that, to the extent you're part of what the real vision, the necessary vision of our humanity demands. And it can be done. If you leave here not to say, that was a great time, leave here not to think about it individually, but leave here to organize for it so that you can do it in a joint way that something really gets done.
You've already begun to answer my questions. I'm struck with these reflections, not only your courage for what you did, but your capacity for exquisite moral discernment. I'd like to ask you to tell these young folks that we're leaving the world to, what are the pressing moral crises right now that you think are the most in need of being dealt with, that have the, that are the moral equivalents of the struggle for racial equality that you were so brave and so smart about?
Well, I think the answer for me is very simple. The greatest moral crisis we're facing as a nation, as a people, and as part of the world community is to end the war. End the war. We can send the strongest possible message to all humanity. End the violence. Stop the killing. Stop wasting hundreds, thousands, millions, and billions of dollars to kill other human being. And I don't understand it. It was good for people to be in Washington yesterday, and they're going to be on Capitol Hill tomorrow and this week, lobbying members of Congress. But the American people are too quiet. We need to get in the streets all across this land. We live in a democratic society. It's supposed to be a democracy. We spoke with our votes on November 7th. Now it's time for us to speak with our feet. We must do it.
One moral crisis that concerns me is what I'll call truth as a value. We know, well, over the years I have seen many instances where people understand that they should tell the truth and face the truth and don't always do it. That's one thing. But I have been encountering people recently that don't even have truth as a value, that don't even start from, well, you need to be truthful. And that seems really tragic for me, because I think they're lost and they're going to stay lost. I grew up Catholic, and we learned the importance of truth, you know, and truth to be good and what have you, and I guess that's fine, but it never excited me. When I began to learn about nonviolence and why be truthful, there were a whole set, new set of reasons. Number one, so that you and people that you're in contact with can have accurate information on which to make your decisions. Now, that was meaningful to me. You know, if the scientists who were trying to get to the moon a few decades ago had not respected truth, and every time they came upon a mathematical computation of, say, 2 plus 2, instead of recording 4, they would say 2 plus 2 equals 8, and sometimes they might say 2 plus 2 equals 1, you can see they never would have made it to the moon. And with your own checkbook, if you tried to balance it without being as accurate as you can, you would just have chaos and a mess. And I think that that is one reason why in the natural sciences, we're in the space age and the technology age, and in our social relationships, we're in primitive stages. So I think understanding that truth is important for practical reasons as well as moral reasons is a moral crisis that concerns me.
All right, Jim?
I haven't gotten up before, but I live out in the Southwest now. And one of the issues that you hear about and you know about every day, the term is usually illegal immigration. Every year in the deserts of southern Arizona, literally hundreds of men, women, and children who are seeking a better life for themselves and their families die trying to get to the promised land. We look at them as illegal aliens. The term that we used to hear was nigger or nigger lover. Down there it's wetback. But these are human beings. And what we so often miss, and I feel we need to work for, and I'm trying increasingly to help people understand, is that this is a humanitarian issue. These individuals who want a better life are told by the coyotes that it is a 4-hour walk to freedom. They are given a gallon of water, and they frequently give up their life savings to have the coyote dump them at the border. In most places in the desert of southern Arizona, it is not a 4-hour walk to water or to freedom. It is a 4-day walk. And there is no water. A few months ago, two young people your age came upon some individuals who were very close to death, terribly dehydrated. And rather than calling 911, they put them in their vehicle and raced to get them help. They were stopped by the police and arrested for transporting illegal aliens. Humanitarianism should never be a crime. I see that as a big issue where I live. And I just want you, I hope you will look at it the same way. These are human beings, very much looking for freedom and their own justice and their own opportunity for life. Thank you.
Go ahead, Diane. Tony, go ahead.
I really want us to talk, Jim. I agree with you as far as the humanitarian aspect. But I think that although mine and most progressive people's attitude 20 years ago is different from what it is now, I think we need to rethink that issue because the circumstances are different. One reason that there are so many million people who have entered the country by breaking the immigration laws is that the big corporations want them to do exactly that because they want to exploit them and pay them unlivable wages. I think that we need to look at the situation and perhaps come up with different solutions rather than just millions of people coming into the country. What I'd like to see us do is get with them and change the plantation capitalism or the colonialism in their countries of origin that make life so miserable there that they have to leave their own country in order to have a decent life. I'm concerned about the issue of how black people relate to that issue because that is a big lie about the immigrants are taking jobs that Americans don't want. Less than a year ago, a Walmart opened about in Evergreen Park, Illinois, which is about one block outside the Chicago city limits. 23,500 people applied for 300 and some jobs. The number of black men who are in prison and therefore off the job market now is very closely allied with the issue of immigration. Massive immigration makes it virtually impossible for unions to organize. There are many, many issues right now that I think deserve a second look. And I think we ought to be very humanitarian. But black people, black Americans, built this country. And I resent having our young men in such large numbers being in jail and others unemployed and unable to get jobs. While any other group leapfrogs ahead of us and has economic stability. So what I'm saying is I think that we need to look at that whole thing and see what sensible solutions are available and get involved.
Jim, yeah.
Tighten up because we have only approximately 13 minutes, I think, and we're supposed to end this by noon. Is that right, Mark? Yeah, okay. So let's stop all applause. Okay?
I'll forgive you for that, Jim. Thank you very much, Jim. I've been sitting here listening to... to the values of these people I watched and admired long ago and still admiring. And I'm reminded that this is Sunday. I, like Diane, was raised in the Catholic tradition, and I look around this room, my guess is that there are a few denominations not represented here. And it occurs to me as I sit here and listen again to these people I so admire, that considering yesterday on the bus, in museums, in churches, what I heard was, and what I hear again, is a unified expression of moral values and commitment. And I just want to say to you, don't worry that you haven't been in a church or a mosque or a temple this weekend. There is no mosque or temple or church where you could have been, where you had heard a homily or a sermon that was more committed to meaningful moral values than what you have heard from these courageous leaders, one and all. I never go on a campus but what some young person says, you know, what's happened to the movement? Where have all the flowers gone? You know, why is there not something we can do? And over these 2 days, you've heard from them that discrimination is alive and well. It still exists. It's directed toward African Americans. It's directed towards Muslims. Legal, law-abiding Muslims, as Jim's word just said. Immigrants, not just Hispanic, of all nationalities, suffer discrimination. People suffer discrimination because of their lifestyle. However any of that affects you, it seems to me what the unified voice is saying is, you know, there are ways you can find to attack discrimination, and you can do it. And I look at you and remember them, and they were your age and younger when they changed the life of a community, changed the life of a region, changed the life of a nation, because racism was nationwide. And if you make that commitment, the flowers won't be gone to the graveyard, every one.
Thank you. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it is my opinion that America, and more importantly, Americans, were ready for the civil rights movement. And I say that because the evils of slavery and the evils of racism and segregation were so prevalent for so long and so explicit in the fabric of America. And then I think about the problems of today, problems that we've already mentioned, like plantation capitalism, immigration, economic exploitation, violence, warfare, poverty, hunger. I mean, the list goes on and on. And these problems seem so obvious to me and to everyone in this room. But on the other hand, it appears to me almost as though we can see these problems as obvious and then just turn our backs from them on the other hand. I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with this concept. It's doublethink. It's an Orwellian concept from 1984. Time out. The question I had is, how can we take these implicit problems, these problems that are so far away, so distant, like hunger in Africa, and how can we make them a movement, a mass movement, raise the consciousness level of everyone so that they're not distant problems, but they're problems that apply to everyone everywhere?
You heard me say the other day, maybe on a bus or someplace along the way, back in the 60s, we didn't have the technology. You have everything today. Call it what you may. You can call it the spirit of history, the spirit of God Almighty, divine providence intervening, but something intervened. We allowed ourselves to be used. We got in the way. And today, you can use the blog, you can use the internet, you can use this technology to communicate with the world. We didn't have CNN. We had the three major networks. We use what we had. Allow yourself to be used.
just get in the way and just do it.
Just in case you didn't quite understand being used, right, is that don't be misused, right? And if you're really worried, information is all you need. How can we sit here and watch $300 billion, right, being misused, and we don't talk about it? How do we talk about hunger in Africa when there's hunger here? How can we talk about a Martin King and praise his name when he said there is something wrong with the nation that creates poverty, creates hunger, creates homelessness, all right? Is that everything that we can talk about happens right here in the U.S. and is an ideal way to start, right? But if we need to, if we, as you say, it doesn't affect us, it does affect you, all right? $600 billion being spent, about $60 billion we don't even know what happened to. The government doesn't even know what happened to, right? It's been fluffed off. It's been stolen, right? That's really what's happened. We don't you like to use the word stolen because they're not thieves. They're just in a social situation. Now, they're thieves, right? Now, the point being is that when we look at it, start right here at home. Right? This is one reason you've got to get together and organize and say, what's most effective for us to do right now? And as John says, is that war is quite apparent. Look, if we are expending money like that on war, that money is being lost. The other thing we got to demand, just like we did on vote, right? It's one thing to ask the right to vote, it's another thing to ask for the right to be counted. Right? Now, the point is, when we see $600 million, if this war, $600 billion, I mean, if this war stops now, are we going to demand that the money we would have used be used for problems right here at home, human problems? Isn't it interesting? We've had an administration that has shown very little to no concern about suffering, of any of the problems of human beings. They've been very concerned about other places, but not here, because it's a part of an underlying understanding of empire, right? We got to get that out of the mind. We got to make certain that the main thing is, what's going to happen to this nation so we can become a witness to the rest of the world is how to win it, not by bombing people and killing people and destroying cultures, right? But in fact, by so doing our job of reaching human beings that they want to be a part of what we talk about. We don't even have full democracy yet, right? And we're telling other people that they should have democracy, and we're dictating the form of it to them. Is that let us start right here. Do the job so well and make the demand so explicit that there's no hiding place.
John, I may misquote you on this one, but I remember how often people were pushing back and saying, "Don't, you're going too fast." And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think your words were, if not us now, then who? Or if not us, then who? If not now, then when? Don't, was that right?
Yeah, Jim Farmer said it. Jim Farmer titled the book.
Yeah, but somebody said it. Somebody said that. I like that. And I'm going to just go one little step further. Don't wait for somebody else to take the first step. Don't wait for somebody else to take the first move. You do it. You get out there and organize. You find the people that will work with you. You get it started. That's your challenge. as you leave this place.
Oh, I just want to help you out. In case anybody else tell you, you can't clap anymore. This is the way we clap in the movement that we're creating in nonviolence training. I don't know whether to save any more time or not, but, you know. But it's another culture. It's the way the Jain religion, the lotus, thing. Also the deaf, the people who can't hear, you clap, they don't care anyway, okay? So that's the way we use that. So we have to be multicultural. And I know that people say charity must begin at home, and you must do what you must do here. But I want to hasten to say that we have to go into all the world. Because sometimes to get at the problems here, we have to take the route that might lead us other places to get here. And you don't want to wait until everything gets right here. Otherwise, you will just be buried here. Some people have got to work here, and some people have got to work there, and all of us got to work everywhere. So I want to get you the notion. I want to dispel that notion. Because in the first place, the very folk you're talking about, okay, they don't live in Atlanta anymore. They don't live in Nashville anymore. Suppose they stayed in Nashville and said, we're going to get Nashville straight. Well, second thought, he's getting Nashville straight, but you know, he stayed. But no. Don't. You must go where you are led, and you must do what you have to do. And I want to say that, yes, we live in a world house. Don't stay in one room. Because you can learn more about what's happening in the United States if you go other places. You can't know one country unless you really know two, because it's by comparison and by association, disassociation. We're still world citizens. I just left Germany, speaking for Martin Luther King's Day celebration. And you know what I learned? 60% of the inmates, our soldiers in jail, Diane, are black. They left the United States to go get in jail in Germany. And NAACP is complaining because they don't have money to hire lawyers to help them because they use military lawyers. And you know what that happens. Okay? So what she's talking about is real. But it's all over. We are not domesticated. We're undomesticated. And the very fact that we're over there in Iraq talking about jumping on Iran means that we got commitments all over this world. And yes, we do have to respond. And everything people are saying, I agree with, but I just want to emphasize that you must go where you are led and do what you got to do. I'm going to stay home here. I ain't going to move out of the country. We have expatriates. I met some of them over there. They're in Germany because they didn't like the United States. They live a better life in Germany. That puzzles me. But, you know, they're expatriates. A lot of folks here are expatriates. In fact, we all may be expatriates, come to think of it. Yeah. So my point is, find a place where you can make your contribution. And the main point I want to leave with is this. Don't be satisfied with trying to get some barbecue and a Mercedes, okay? And a suburban home somewhere and a condo, okay? And a timeshare or whatever, okay? Don't be satisfied with that with your life. What I'm saying to you is that, like Martin Luther King, you got to find something worth dying for before you can begin to live. Life is short. When I hear these guys talking about they're 80 years old, that scares me.
You also say it must be maladjusted.
Maladjusted. That's right. John got that part. Yeah. Maladjusted. No, okay. So what I'm saying is that the world is your home. And what directly, okay, affects one person indirectly affects all of us. We are affected by what's happening there. So don't talk about getting your house straight first and all that. It ain't going to get in order. All right? But in the meantime, sometimes the route to getting home is through the wilderness. So don't stay here. Expose yourself. Travel. Go places. See what's happening in other places. Learn information. Learn about other people. Learn other languages. You know how the war in Iraq is going to stop? Two ways. Number one, John and his colleagues are going to cut the budget. The next thing that's going to happen is China is going to come to the table. You understand? Everybody owes China. That's the big bear. Okay? When China says, okay, let's cut this out, and y'all, you know, we can help y'all with some of the balance of debt here and that kind of thing, and let's bring all the Arab countries together, all right, and say, well, no, we don't want to continue this. All right? There has to be a reason. And that's what's going to happen. You mark my word. You got it on tape. It's going to happen. All right? So, but we have to work at it. It's not going to be automatic because they're not going to cut the budget until some people cut the food. All right? And you guys are going to have to be maladjusted. You can't be, you know, just calm and cool to make this happen. So, those are my final words, is go into all the world and be maladjusted.
All right, the bottom line is that any kind of serious faith, any kind of serious understanding of life acknowledges that each of us is in the image of the life of life itself, whether we call that God or love or truth, the psychical energy of the universe, whatever and however we try to mark that. And the point is, however, that where each of us has cultivated that life gift and run with it to the utmost, you both become a majority of one in the world, as well as deeply engaged in the whole community. So nonviolence fundamentally maintains that nonviolent power is the power each of us is given at birth, and the capacity to use it and be more than what you could ever imagine, and be where you did not expect to be, and go where you did not expect to go. Is part of the amazing adventure of being alive and human. So we'll end this panel this morning with that. I thank my colleagues for all that they have done. As I said the other night, they are, to me, family, the essence of family in the world. And I love them, and I support them inwardly and outwardly wherever they are in our world. They do represent a remarkable group of people. Thank you so much this morning.